My Classic Album with Mike Norris is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of My Classic Album and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.
A very special edition of My Classic Album, the show where we look back on some of the greatest albums in music history. I'm Mike Norris, and the reason that this episode is so special is that for the first time in the podcast's history, rather than looking at a studio album by a band or a singer, we're going to be looking at a soundtrack from a movie. And that's a pretty big deal, I think, for the podcast. The album that's been chosen today, the soundtrack that's been chosen today, is the soundtrack to the 1975 movie The Rocky Horror Picture Show. And my special guest, Savannah Poe, who chose the album, will be joining us very soon to chat about why it's her classic album and what makes it such a significant soundtrack as well. Not just in the history of cinema, but in the history of music as well. It is quite a significant film. Obviously, it is a musical, but there are reasons why it is a significant film in terms of the history of British and American music. And we talk about that quite a lot in our chat that's coming up in just a little bit. Savannah was a great guest. Really enjoyed having her on the show. And if we were going to start with a soundtrack, for me, it seems like the Rocky Horror Picture Show, judging from the other albums we've done in the past, it fits in really well with the albums and the singers and the bands that we've touched on so far. And I must admit that the Rocky Horror Picture Show is undoubtedly one of my favourite soundtracks of all time. And the soundtrack, for me, is a huge part of what makes the movie. And it was interesting, because when I was thinking about other soundtracks that I enjoy, they're an integral part of the movie viewing experience for me. So a film like Flash Gordon, and I'm sure so many people would agree that a huge part of, you know, the success and the following that Flash Gordon has, the 1980 version of Flash Gordon, is down to the soundtrack by Queen. Now, everyone knows I'm a huge Queen fan, but I don't think there's many people who would disagree with me that a huge part of what makes that film so successful is Queen's soundtrack. And you know, maybe it's not in like the top five Queen albums of all time by any stretch, but it's a great soundtrack. And I listen to it in a very different way than I would listen to A Night at the Opera or Sheer Heart Attack, which we did a couple of years ago. I also love the soundtracks in Tarantino movies. I love Tarantino movies, full stop. And it's funny because it's not particularly, you know, people go on about the violence and the language in Tarantino films. It doesn't turn me off them, but it's certainly not what attracts me to them. I think he's a fantastic director, a fantastic screenwriter, and he's just got this perfect habit of putting the perfect music for the perfect scene at the perfect time. You know, look no further than Reservoir Dogs, where, you know, Mr. Blonde is in the warehouse and he's about to cut that guy's ear off and it's Steeler's Wheel stuck in the middle with you. And yet it works. There's something about it that works. And I can't listen to that song now, as I'm sure millions of people can't listen to that song now, without thinking of Mr. Blonde and Reservoir Dogs. And he's done it to great effect in so many other films. And I'm excited to see Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is out in a couple of months. And I'm excited to see again what he does with the soundtrack for that. Will he stick to music that's from the time period that he's in? Or will he dot about? Because even in a film like Inglourious Basterds, he was using David Bowie at one point, who, if you think chronologically, David Bowie wasn't even recording music when the film was set. So he's not afraid to experiment and be quite bold with the music he uses. And as a consequence, his soundtracks are amazing. Perhaps a more recent example or examples that I really enjoy soundtrack-wise at the minute are the soundtracks to the Guardians of the Galaxy movies. So anyone who watches the Marvel Cinematic Universe will know what I'm talking about. They are hilarious films. I mean, I love Marvel films in general, but those two films for me are very high up on my list of movies of all time, let alone the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And again, the soundtracks are a part of the plot in a way that's really unique. And I do feel that sometimes they drive the plot forward. Star-Lord has these tapes from his mother that he plays. They're his connection to home, they're his connection to her. Obviously, she's not around anymore. And sometimes, similar to Tarantino, James Gunn just has a habit of getting the right song in the right moment. And it's just perfect. Everything about it is perfect. The very end of Guardians of the Galaxy 2. I'm not going to spoil it for anyone in case they haven't seen it. I know it's a 2-year-old film now, but if you haven't seen it, that's one of the best examples I can think of the right song in the right moment, at the right time in the movie. And I cry every time. I've been asking on social media for your thoughts on soundtracks that you enjoy. And I'm going to read a couple of them out. Check out our social media pages if you haven't already. Get yourself to My Classic Album with Mike Norris on Facebook and like the page. You can follow us on Instagram at My Classic Album Podcast, or you can follow us on Twitter at MCA_podcast. And I simply asked the question not long ago, what your favourite soundtracks are. That was it. Simple as that. Stephen Holt said Forrest Gump, which I thought was a really good one. And I love Forrest Gump, another film that makes me cry. Although anyone who knows me particularly well will know that that's not a hard feat when we're watching movies. Some of you may remember Jacqueline Dillon from our Battle of Hell episode a couple of years ago. Jacqueline actually commented on the post, and she said that she thinks that Hedwig and the Angry Inch was a great soundtrack. Not actually a film I've even seen, let alone a soundtrack I've heard, so I'm going to have to check that out. Bruce Harris went with Top Gun, as did a couple of people, actually. Top Gun was a very popular one. Ian Gordon named a few. He said, I think I've listened to Garden State, Me, Myself and Irene, and Almost Famous soundtracks more than any others. All great. And Paula Green named a couple as well. Dirty Dancing, Cruel Intentions, Kill Bill, A Star Is Born. I think A Star Is Born is one that people will talk about for quite a few years. I hadn't really thought about that, actually, until just now. Kill Bill, talking about Tarantino, another amazing soundtrack from him. So they're just a few of the soundtracks that people really love and feel strongly about and just make them want to watch the film all over again. And of course, the Rocky Horror Picture Show is in that list. It is a phenomenal soundtrack, and I think now is the perfect time to get into my conversation with our special guest today. My special guest is Savannah Pope, and she has chosen the soundtrack to the Rocky Horror Picture Show. But before we get to Savannah, here are just the facts. Here's the beginning of what you need to know about the soundtrack to the Rocky Horror Picture Show. August 1975 saw the release of the Rocky Horror Picture Show, the movie adaptation of the offbeat theatre show written by Richard O'Brien. After seeing a performance of the Rocky Horror Show in London in 1973, producer Lou Adler would immediately acquire the US performance rights for the show, and the wheels began to turn for a movie adaptation. Richard Hartley would arrange the score for the London theatre run of Rocky Horror, return to produce the soundtrack to the film. As well as performances from the likes of Tim Curry, Meatloaf and Susan Sarandon, the soundtrack to the Rocky Horror Picture Show also boasts performances from members of Procol Harum. Drummer BJ Wilson and guitarist Mick Grabham joined the likes of John Bundrick and Dave Wintour to bring Hartley's score to life. The Rocky Horror Picture Show attained a cult following quickly upon release, but nothing that would initially translate to major success. As a result, the soundtrack released alongside the movie was actually deleted everywhere but Canada. Marty Scott of Gem Records made an agreement with Adler for the album to be made available in the US via import. Gem Records then produced and distributed copies of the album, seeing sales of its soar. In 1978, 3 years after the movie's release, the soundtrack to the Rocky Horror Picture Show reached number 49 on the Billboard 200. The cult following of the movie certainly helped. Over 40 years after its release, the Rocky Horror Picture Show is currently the longest running theatrical release in cinema history. The movie and the songs within it were celebrated by US TV show Glee in 2010, causing the original soundtrack to return to the Billboard 200, 35 years after its initial release. A 2016 revival on TV network Fox saw the likes of Laverne Cox and Adam Lambert bring the songs to a whole new generation of fans, but it remains the 1975 score that has captured the hearts and imaginations of Rocky Horror fanatics the world over for nearly 45 years. So that's just the beginning of what we need to know about the Rocky Horror Picture Show, and I have here with me my very special guest who's chosen this album to talk about today on My Classic Album. This is Savannah Pope. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. How are you?
I'm great, and I'm very excited that we're doing a soundtrack, and particularly that we're doing the Rocky Horror Picture Show of all the soundtracks that we could choose. Why have you chosen it to talk about on My Classic Album today?
I mean, I guess I consider it to be a record. It technically was a record. It was in the charts, not technically when it was released, but several years afterwards when it garnered more of a cult following. So it is an album. But yeah, I love the music from this play. I think, you know, there are plenty of rock operas that are great and classic and what have you, but the music for this one is so, to me, particularly incredible. And that's what stands out about it. I mean, amongst many other things, but it solidifies it as a classic to me. And yeah, I just love this music. I fell in love with Rocky Horror when I was really young. You know, I think for my 11th birthday party, I had a Rocky Horror birthday party, and the parents were very upset with me about it. Many of my classmates. And so I've been in love with this film and the soundtrack for such a long time. So I'm just psyched to be able to talk about it with somebody.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I remember my first time seeing the movie. I can't remember the year, but it was actually New Year's Day. So we used to, me and my friends, have these big house parties. We'd all take turns kind of hosting it. And on this particular, what I used to do, and I've mentioned this a little bit on another podcast we did, that for house parties, particularly for New Year's Eve and New Year's Day, I would often stay up because I'd want to see the day in. And everybody else was asleep or passed out drunk. And I was flicking through the channels at about 3 a.m. And the Rocky Horror Picture Show was on. And I just remember, obviously, I'd heard of it and I'd heard of Time Warp. People who haven't even seen the film have heard of Time Warp, but I'd never sat and watched the film. And there was me and another friend of mine who, it happened to be his house that we were having the party. And we just sat, and he'd seen it many times. And we just sat and watched this film. And I mean, as we'll get into, there's so much to unpick with this film. What are your memories of seeing it for the first time? And did you hear the soundtrack first, or did you watch the film and that was how you fell in love with the music?
I watched the film and that's how I fell in love with the music. And yeah, I mean, it's just really infectious. It's a great soundtrack. And I think, I don't know, it's sort of like it's a great mix of things. It's got that sort of like Chuck Berry pastiche. and then, you know, a great foundation of glam, of like, you know, tiny elements of what would become punk, and also just enough pop to make it really stick in your head. So yeah, I mean, I saw the movie when I must have been maybe 9 or 10 when I saw it. Both my parents worked all the time, so I watched kind of whatever I wanted. I would just rent movies and watch them. I remember it being very sexy and not fully understanding what that meant, but just being like, oh, okay, this is like, I'm gonna watch this movie alone. I don't want people around when I watch this. And I remember it being, I just loved the fashion, and I loved the music, and I loved the boldness of it. I also, I'm a huge fan of horror and sci-fi, and I was as a little kid as well. And this paid homage to that so brilliantly. I actually didn't fall in love with glam or punk until later, particularly glam, but it just makes sense that later I would love glam rock so much and then come back to look at this and be like, oh, this is so glam.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll talk a lot more about that, because I think that's one of the reasons that when you chose it, I was very much of the opinion that it was the perfect soundtrack to be our first soundtrack on My Classic Album. I guess what a lot of people listening might wonder is what takes this from simply being a great soundtrack to an essential album that should be in anyone's music collection. Because I don't know how many people know this actually, but when I interview people for the podcast, if I don't have it already, I always buy the album that we've talked about on vinyl. So I'm building this like amazing music collection as chosen by you guys. So what is it that takes Rocky Horror from being this great soundtrack to, like I say, this essential album that everyone should own?
I mean, again, I just think it's a great album. It's really comprehensive. It goes through kind of all the great elements that make up a great glam rock album. It's got like bits of sort of Roxy music-esque cabaret. It's got, you know, the whole shine back to the 50s of, you know, those great guitar swings and those, you know, Jerry Lee Lewis piano parts. I mean, the musicality is just beautiful. And the lyrics, I mean, for me, it's mostly about the lyrics. I think Richard O'Brien is just a brilliant, brilliant lyricist. For instance, when I'm in my car driving, I listen to Over at the Frankenstein Place all the time. That one in particular for me is very meaningful, and it's just a beautiful song. If it had never been in a movie, I would love it. I think the same with probably Sweet Transvestite, because it's so brilliant. And yeah. I mean, yeah, it goes through so many genres like any great album does. while staying firmly rooted in whatever its theme is, which I think in this case is like sexually exploratory glam.
So the album specifically that we're discussing today, just for anyone who's kind of maybe new to Rocky Horror, is the soundtrack of the 1975 movie, which itself was an adaptation of the stage show The Rocky Horror Show, which started life in London in 1973. So written by Richard O'Brien, which you've touched on, he stars in the movie and he performs on the soundtrack as Riff Raff. Now, there are many cast recordings from various stage productions from before and after the film was made. And of course, there was the TV special from a couple of years back. AllMusic calls this soundtrack the definitive version of the Rocky Horror score. What is it that makes it so special compared to all these other ones?
Well, they got to really do a proper separate recording of it. And I mean, they did it in less than 2 weeks, which is pretty amazing. But they did. They did a, you know, beautiful studio recording. They brought in strings and horns and everything. And then they brought in the cast and they recorded it all in the studio and did it exactly the way that they wanted it to sound.
Yeah. So if we consider that Richard O'Brien wrote the musical in the early 70s in the UK, and again, you've started to touch on this already, glam rock is a hugely influential thing at the time in terms of music and fashion, particularly in London, where he was based. And in fact, Richard was heavily involved in that scene. I've got a quote here that says, "Glam rock allowed me to be myself more." So we've started to touch on this. How integral is glam rock to the Rocky Horror Picture Show? Not only musically, but perhaps in terms of kind of ethos and as you touched on, fashion as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think entirely. And I think in a great way, it introduced, because if you look back at the history of glam rock, which if you're a glam rock nerd like me, you do. 1973 wasn't necessarily, it wasn't a worldwide phenomenon yet. Like Bowie was just kind of getting out there. Bolan was pretty big. T-Rex was pretty big. You know, Roxy Music had just released their first album, you know, eponymous album. So it was all just breaking into, you know, the charts. And it was much bigger in the UK than it was anywhere else. I really appreciate this piece of art looking at it. You know, obviously I wasn't there, but yeah. From what I can tell, it seems like it introduced a lot of the themes of glam rock into pop culture in a way that people didn't even know it was glam. And I really appreciate that, because when I was a kid, I didn't know what glam was. And this sort of brought me into a lot of the things that I love about glam. So yeah, I think the open sexuality, the sexual fluidity, which, you know, you saw a lot of, I think glam was the beginning of seeing, I guess, androgyny and gender play and stuff in more popular rock scenes. So that's really brought to the forefront with this. I think musically it's very glam. Like I said before, it's kind of brings together a bunch of different elements of like harder rock and, you know, guitar harmonies and all of these things that were just starting at the time. And then in terms of just the feel and the ethos of it, it's very glamorous. The whole thing, it's very overdone. Everyone's very dramatic. Everyone's very camp. I always think of glam rock that has like a self-effacing grandiloquence. And that's just all over this whole soundtrack and movie, I think.
And it's just, I've got a quote from an article from thequietist.com who basically they've got some really more practical reasons why glam and Rocky Horror go side by side, just more from circumstance in some ways. So as I say, the Rocky Horror ensemble mingled with their musical counterparts. Little Nell, who played Columbia, had a stall at Kensington Market next to Freddie Mercury's. Mick Rock, court photographer to glam royalty, took the classic portrait shots of the cast. The makeup for the film version was created by Pierre Laroque, who designed several classic Bowie faces, including the Aladdin Sane lightning bolt. And the Rolling Stones began using their iconic mouth trademark after Rocky Horror's lips and teeth logo. So it seems there's a clearly defined link between the glam music scene and the people behind Rocky Horror. So not only kind of intent, but just obviously by circumstance and just what was happening around them in London at the time that was being written and the film was being planned.
Yeah, well, I know Jagger really wanted to play Frankenfurter in the movie, but they decided to keep Tim Curry on.
Yeah, yeah. And I think obviously we'll get onto Tim Curry plenty in a bit, but I think that was obviously absolutely the right move. I feel like there's this kind of battle, and you've touched on this as well a little bit within the movie, of kind of glam rock versus rock and roll. So the music, a lot of the music, is very much in the vein of that 1950s rock and roll. There's one point in particular where I think that that's really played out on screen, and we'll get to that later. If we consider like the androgynous nature of a character like Dr. Frankenfurter, he is the very epitome of what the glam movement was about, kind of pushing against some of the more traditional characters and elements of the story. Does that kind of make sense? And kind of, do you think that I'm kind of picking that up right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it makes sense even when you look at the movie being made. Like Meat Loaf, when they initially brought him in, actually walked out of rehearsal when he saw Frankenfurter in costume for the first time. He was like, no, too weird. Especially when you're doing something that's as quick as this. Like I said, the album was recorded in 2 weeks and the movie was made in, I think, 6 weeks, which is just insane to me because I just think it's so good. But yeah, I'm sure a lot of real life leaks into what you're doing artistically.
Yeah, totally. So the moment that the stage show becomes a movie is when American producer Lou Adler gets involved. So Lou saw a performance of the show in London with Britt Eklund and immediately secured the performance rights for the US. And it's this point where the cogs begin to turn for what would become the movie. So Lou talks to Rolling Stone in 2015 about why he was so taken by the show. So he says, well, Tim Curry's legs to begin with. As much as he had a manly feel about him, it was seeing him dressed as Frankenfurter in heels. When it was playing at the Roxy, even if I didn't go for the whole show, I always made sure I was there for the entrance. So it was that and the music. I was brought up in the 50s with that pop rock and roll music. The fact that musicals had any rock and roll sense, like Hair or Jesus Christ Superstar, was interesting. Musicals all had Broadway-type music then. That's what got me. And I guess, again, there's so many types of musicals and movie adaptations of musicals now, and jukebox musicals and rock operas and everything, that it's strange that at one time, you know, the idea of rock and roll in a musical was quite revolutionary.
Right. Well, it makes sense that O'Brien would even think of leaning towards that because he was a play actor and he'd been in both of those plays.
I think so. Yeah. I think so.
Yeah. So yeah, he came by it honestly.
Yeah. So Lou used many of the UK cast, including Richard O'Brien as Riff Raff, Patricia Quinn as Magenta, and as we've said, Tim Curry returned as Dr. Frankenfurter in the final movie. How important do you think that was in kind of keeping the essence of the original stage show?
I think really important. I think Tim Curry is... I love Tim Curry. I actually almost ran over his dog once. And it was both exciting and traumatic. Like, he just had this teeny little fluffy dog. And it's just like, you know, one of those weird things about living in LA is sometimes you just look up and people that you've loved your entire life are there.
Yeah.
And yeah, there was this teeny little dog ran into the street and I stopped immediately when I saw it. And then I looked up and Tim Curry was walking it and I couldn't even speak. I was just like, and he just sort of like waved it off and walked away.
You know what it is? I've been doing this podcast for nearly 3 years. Sometimes people just love the album and they've never met the person before. Sometimes they've been lucky enough to work with them or meet them in some capacity. That is my favourite story I've heard in 3 years.
I almost ran over. Oh my God. Well, first of all, I never want to run over any living thing. No. So I'm really glad I didn't. But also, like, to top it off, if I had run over Tim Curry's dog, I don't think I would have gotten over that.
Trying to get back on track, what Lou also shrewdly did was ensure that there was some American influence on the film, and therefore the soundtrack. So this includes the casting of Barry Bostwick and Susan Sarandon as Brad and Janet, and Meat Loaf, the decision to have him reprise his role of Eddie from the Broadway production. What do you think the presence of these performers has on the album?
I mean, you know, makes it transatlantic, I suppose, which is good because it's sort of supposed to exist out of anything normal or easily defined. So it's good to have a mixture of people in there. I also think it's great to set it in America because America, you know, especially in comparison to Europe traditionally, and at the time is seen as such a puritanical place. So then when you have like this, you know, well, I guess are you guys technically European anymore?
Well, who knows at this point?
Who knows? I hope you are. I love coming over there.
Well, I hope so too, but I don't know.
crazy world. Well, certainly at the time, considered to be, you know, to have this European influence just corrupting these, and in a positive way, obviously, because they end up loving it, but corrupting these, like, totally brainwashed American 30-year-old virgins is just perfect to me.
So, I mean, this might be entirely unintentional, but it kind of links to what we're talking about. If we think about the idea of kind of that glam is very much, at this point, it's very much a British phenomenon, and there's that kind of glam versus rock and roll aspect to it. It seems that a lot of the British cast members are primarily the Transylvanians, you know, Tim Curry, Richard O'Brien, etc. And the Americans are playing the far more traditional characters, including Eddie, who's probably the closest we've got to kind of a middle ground, who's still the personification of that 50s rock and roll dream. So again, it's almost this idea of kind of the British invasion coming over and corrupting, as you said, like the puritanical American cast members.
Yeah, I mean, it's like if you think of American music in the 60s, it's like the sexiest thing we had was Elvis, which is, you know, much more traditional than something like Bowie. Yeah. You know, those are two different beasts.
I mean, I wonder as well if Lou's kind of Americanizing of the production was an attempt to make the film a bit more accessible in the US. So it's easy to forget that there were many states in America in the mid-70s where being gay was still illegal. Yeah, here we have a movie with kind of a pansexual crossdresser as one of its main characters. I suppose it's easy for us to forget how shocking that would have been, particularly in mid-70s America when Kiss, for example, everyone thought that Kiss was Satanist because they dressed up in face paint.
Yeah, totally. And I think it also, I think having, I mean, we'll get into it later, but I think also the degree of female sexual aggression in it was really revolutionary. And you never saw that in movies at the time. And they really brought it into the soundtrack as well. I'm sure it shook things up quite a bit. I mean, you know, initially it was a midnight movie. Like you couldn't see it before midnight.
So I've got a quote from David Bowie at this point, and it's a quote about the difference between what the UK and the US, their interpretations of glam. And it's from the foreword of Mick Rock's Glam and Eyewitness account. And I think it's interesting to throw in at this point because it shows that while the UK audience may have found some familiarity in Tim Curry's performance, it was totally alien to anyone watching in the US. So here's the quote from David Bowie. He said, "British glam rock never made an impact on middle America to any extent. Before and after, we were bookended by Alice and Kiss. Butch manly glam, with lots of guillotines and fireworks, muscles and metal. No mistaking the sexual bent of those fellas. Nothing ambiguous about our boys. That's the only way Ohio could accept lipstick on males."
It's that kind of thought that, obviously, David Bowie has even spotted that the American version of glam was almost kind of butched up a little bit in compared to the androgynous nature of, kind of say, a Mark Bolan or a David Bowie.
Totally. You know, I was just talking to one of the writers at LA Weekly who is trans, and she was in metal bands and what have you throughout the 80s, and she was telling me just how transphobic and homophobic in general that scene was, like the glam metal scene in America, which I just think is so interesting and also dumb when you think about it, because it's like they're really just a step away from each other, you know?
So William Rollman's review of the soundtrack on AllMusic says that for the soundtrack, Adler brought back original London stage musicians in place of the slick studio musicians who had marred the LA cast album. This crucially includes Richard Hartley, who's credited as the producer for the soundtrack. Have you heard the LA cast recording? And if so, how does it compare to what Richard Hartley and the London musicians were doing?
I've never heard the LA cast recording.
Interestingly, I did have a bit of a listen to it. The difference for me is it just sounds too clean. It's very, very slick's the perfect word, which is what they use in that quote there. It's musically, there's no doubt that obviously there's some very talented musicians on board, but it just doesn't have the same feel as this one. And I guess it was interesting just to throw that in because obviously Lou had spotted that and thought, right, if we're going to make this film, we're going to make it properly. How am I going to do that? And that's why he obviously got the London musicians and he got Richard Hartley to produce the soundtrack as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can tell when something is impassioned or not. It just shows up in the music. Like, even if it's done masterfully, it just ends up sounding like somebody's thesis if it's all a bunch of people who aren't connected to it.
So there are some differences between the film score and what was being performed on stage. And similarly, some songs from the movie aren't actually present on the soundtrack. So Brad's Once in a While isn't actually in the movie. I think it's a deleted scene. While Planet Shmanet Janet and The Sword of Damocles didn't make it to the soundtrack for many years. I think there are editions of it out now.
that include them, but that initial releasing of the soundtrack doesn't include those songs. Is that a detriment to the soundtrack? Or do you think the album flows all right without them? Are they two songs that particularly, that for you, enhance the experience of listening to this album?
No, I mean, when I listen through it, I listen through the original. That's just what I've had for many years. So that's what I always go through. Even in the album, I don't even really notice the reprises very much. So no, I don't think so. I think Time Warp makes a big difference. And it's so interesting to me that that's the last song that they did. It just happened in rehearsal because they were like, oh, we need something people can dance to. We need like a pure pop number, which is always that. I feel like that happens a lot with music. You know, for instance, like songs like Moon Age Daydream or Starman, I think were written, you know, the A&R guy told Bowie, like, oh, you need something that people can automatically latch on to. So he just wrote it last minute. I think it ends up happening where people already have, you know, the whole ethos and their whole feel. And then it's just easy to come up with that last thing that sums it up.
Absolutely. So just before we go track by track, we've talked a lot about the movie's link to the glam rock genre, but many, including Patricia Quinn, and I believe you did actually mention this earlier on as well, believe that Rocky Horror was a direct influence on punk. So Patricia said on the DVD commentary for the 25th anniversary of the movie, I maintain that Sue Blaine, who was the costume designer for Rocky Horror, invented punk. Huh. That's a very strong statement. Would you agree with that, or even just the notion that the movie had an impact on punk, which would obviously come along a couple of years later?
I would say yes, though I don't think punk ever went quite as... I think punk can be littered with the same machismo that metal can. So I don't think it penetrated the same way that glam did, where it was all very fluid. I don't think, and you see it now in some punk, but it's very fought for. It's not at the heart of it. So I think stylistically, yeah, I mean, like the fishnets and all, you know, all the rips and everything, that's all, you know, that's all very much in there. And I think the glam in general directly led to punk. I mean, you know, I don't think punk would have existed without Iggy Pop or, you know, Alice Cooper or whatever.
So now seems a perfect time to go track by track. As you'd said, we'll just go with the original album. So those missing tracks will not include, but I'll try and drop in whereabouts they'd be in the movie for anyone who would feel appeased by that. we'll start with Science Fiction double feature. So obviously the opening track on the album, and indeed the beginning of the movie, sung by Richard O'Brien, which I didn't know for years that was Richard O'Brien. The song is somewhat of a tribute to the kind of B-movies that the Rocky Horror Show is parodying, paying tribute to. How do you think Science Fiction double feature fares as an opening track to this album?
Oh, I think it's so perfect. I love it. I think it's really... Well, first of all, I think the production on it is really beautiful. It's kind of simple. And for instance, like the way that the guitars pan is creepy. And it's just a simple way to do it, but it just brings in that element of fun horror. The backing vocals make it sort of classic and playful at the same time. And the organ's really creepy. And again, the lyrics, it's, you know, just the way that he manages to go through so many different influences and pay tribute to them in sort of a farcical way. But I mean, he clearly loves them. You know, he name drops like at least 20 movies in there. And then those are all movies that later you see influencing just the structure and the style and everything about the movie. Like, for instance, like Flash Gordon was there in silver underwear, and then you see Rocky in his gold underwear. And yeah, I mean, it's like a sweet tribute to everything that he loves and everything that's about to happen.
So in some of those movies referenced in Science Fiction double feature include, as you've just touched on, Flash Gordon, the 1934 version. I must add, obviously, the Queen version came much later. The Day the Earth Stood Still, and the 1933 version of King Kong. What are the qualities of these kinds of movies that Rocky Horror is paying tribute to? And obviously, you've started to touch on that with Flash Gordon. What kind of things is it kind of taking from those films to emulate in its own film?
Well, I think in particular, the sci-fi movies, it's very clear, you know, it came from outer space, for instance, just one stylistically, like the kind of kitschy style that they did everything in. And then also, obviously, the content, you know, there's aliens and space stuff. And then it's sort of woven in with this gothic mentality of like depressive futility from like Night of the Demon, you know, which you get in like that gothic house and with songs like Over at the Frankenstein Place. Yeah, I mean, I think it's all woven in there together into the aesthetic and into the material.
So a lot of the songs on the album have been covered many times, and I will touch on a few of them as we go. And obviously they're covered predominantly as songs in their own right, independent from any kind of soundtrack to any adaptation of the film.
Mm-hmm.
So a couple of them here, Jack Antonoff from the band Fun has covered this one, and Joan Jett and the Blackhearts, which I'm absolutely going to have to check out after, because that seems like an amazing pairing. Independent of the movie, what makes this song so appealing that bands seem to want to cover it and make it their own?
Well, I think it's a catalogue of things that influence different aspects of rock and glam. I just think it's sort of haunting and sweet, and it's hauntingly, sweetly beautiful, you know? He could have talked about all this stuff and it could have not been a great song, but it's just a beautiful song. It's great to listen to, and it comes together really gorgeously. So that's what makes it land.
So at this point, we meet Brad and Janet for their opening number, the next song on the album, Damn It, Janet, performed by Barry Boswick and Susan Sarandon. Barry and Susan were cast for the film. They'd not actually appeared in any of the stage productions. What do you feel? For you, I'm guessing they're the definitive versions of Brad and Janet. All music say that they proved to be the best Brad and Janet ever.
What's really funny to me is that Steve Martin desperately wanted to be Brad.
Really?
I kind of would have loved to see. I could totally picture that.
Yeah. Yeah, me too.
But yeah, no, I think they're great. I mean, in a way, they're kind of side characters for me, which I know is funny because they're technically the protagonists, but it's almost something like, okay, well, this weird reference to drop, but like Batman Returns.
Okay.
Like I don't remember Batman at all in that movie. I just remember all of the colorful characters around him. I remember Catwoman. I remember Danny DeVito's weird Penguin Man character. I remember like the evil guy in the factory that created Catwoman, essentially. And all of the colorful characters around them are really what makes it. So they're just sort of like, I don't know, they're like the bread that all the great toppings come on.
It's almost like at this point, they're like almost like an empty canvas that the other characters are going to paint on. I guess that's in some ways with kind of the changes that happen through the film. There's something naive and innocent about Brad and Janet in the beginning. And obviously we go on quite the journey with them as the film and the soundtrack go on.
Yeah.
How does Damn It, Janet portray the innocence, perhaps even the awkwardness that they like exude at this point in the film?
That's exactly what I was going to say. Yeah, the way that they sing is very awkward. They do that sort of a lot of like the talky singing, mm-hmm. which works really well in this. And then I think it all starts off super sweet and innocent with just the lyrics. It's like kids singing to each other. And I think the evolution of it is actually brought about by things in the background. Again, I think the audience participation of like the Janet, you know, it's sort of evil sounding. When that comes in, that sort of brings a sort of ominous feel into the song. Yeah, I think just as the song progresses, also in the film, I don't know if you noticed this, but the scenery around them changes throughout the course of the song. So in the beginning, they're like in front of the church and outside, and it's all cute. And then by the end, they're inside the church. But if you notice in the background, by the end, there's just a funeral being prepared in the back. Don't even notice.
No, I'm gonna have to, because I'm blatantly gonna watch this again before it's all said and done. So I'm gonna have to watch out for that.
Yeah, I hope that was done on purpose because that's really funny to me. I think also the use of "damn it" in it is really cute because it's clearly he thinks it's really shocking to say it. The way that he vocalizes the word "damn it," you can tell that he's sort of like, and that's like the first taste of them doing something naughty. And they just build on that throughout.
So like many moments and characters in the film, the phrase, "Damn it, Janet," has actually become iconic in cinematic history. And of course, that's down to the song and this sequence in the film. In fact, Barry Boswick said back in 2003, "For as long as I live, people will be coming up to me and asking me to say, 'Damn it, Janet, I love you.'"
Yeah. I feel like that and Time Warp are the most recognized phrases in terms of just a pop culture lexicon from the whole soundtrack and from the movie.
So the Orlando Sentinel named Dammit Janet amongst the most heartfelt movie moments in 1993. Would you kind of agree it's a heartfelt song? We've talked a little bit about kind of the cutesiness of it and possibly even the awkwardness of it. And of course, we've got a lot more to come with these two later on. But would you agree it's a heartfelt song between the two of them at this point?
I think it's very heartfelt, but I think the only reason it's palatable is that it's so clearly making fun of itself, because I think if it was completely genuine without any sense of irony, it would just be gross. At least to me, I couldn't take it. Oh God. Yeah, no, I can't take happy songs without minor chords in it. You know, I need something, some hint of self-awareness. So yeah, I think that accomplishes that and makes it a very heartfelt while fun song, because it's making fun of itself at the same time.
And that's Savannah Pope there chatting with me about the official soundtrack to the Rocky Horror Picture Show, her chosen classic album. And we're going to be getting back to my chat with Savannah in just a little bit. It is really interesting to unpick all of this and say that it's more than just kind of a wacky sci-fi film. There's a lot of glam rock influence going in there. It has its own influence on the fashion element of punk. And it's just really exciting to delve in and just see its role in rock history, because it certainly has quite a significant one. So we'll be getting back to my chat with Savannah in just a little bit. First up, I just wanted to play you a track from her debut album, Atlantis. So this came out in between the time that I chatted with Savannah about the soundtrack and it going on air today. So it was great for me to have a listen through to the album, and I absolutely love it. Thoroughly recommend it. You should absolutely check it out. This is Savannah Pope with Rock and Roll No More.
Get a job at the studio and wallow in the bar. Ain't no fucking freeload freak like you gonna be a star. Hey, send trance exams and jam your head with rules. You could be on NPR.
Nobody loves rap. enjoying this episode of My Classic Album? Don't forget there are loads of amazing albums covered in our previous episodes as part of Season 1, with guests including Guns N' Roses keyboardist Dizzy Reed.
If I had to pick one like favorite band or I guess a band that was the biggest influence on me, I would go with the Rolling Stones.
Blues guitarist Big Boy Blotter.
It sounded great then and it sounded great now. It just seems to have stood the test of time with me anyway. So yeah, it's a real classic for me.
And Nathan Stevens Griffin of Martha.
It's a great song musically, you're absolutely right. It's a banger. Mm-hmm. It is like absolutely a barnstormer of an album opener right there.
Also, there's our anniversary episodes, such as 40 Years of Rumours with Fleetwood Mac, including an interview with engineer Ken Kelly.
Within about 15 minutes, the band was fighting. I've seen, you know, Crosby, Stills and Nash fight. I've seen Kenny Loggins and Jim Messina fight, but this was a weird. I've never seen couples fight.
And 40 Years of Bat Out of Hell, including an interview with the voice of Paradise by the Dashboard Light, Ellen Foley.
Time is sometimes tricky. Sometimes things seem like very long ago in another life, which it is, but it all, the memories of it and certainly the song itself is always sort of alive in my mind.
All these episodes and more are available at www.myclassicalbum.co.uk and on Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network.
So we'll move on to Over at the Frankenstein Place. So at this point, Brad and Janet have car trouble and they discover Frank's castle. It's easy amongst all the chaos and fun of this movie to forget that there's actually some fantastic vocal performances on this soundtrack and that we're lucky enough to hear them. Now I think, and it's... I just remember what you said earlier. I think that Over at the Frankenstein Place is perhaps one of the most underrated songs on the album, with that in mind. And I know that you just said before that that's a song that you play in your car on a regular basis.
I love this song. It's one of my all-time favorite songs. It makes me cry, actually. This and I'm Coming Home both make me cry. Oh, I just think it's so beautiful. I think the lyrics are gorgeous. I think Susan Sarandon's performance is really good. It's just so interesting to me because I don't think you hear her singing anything else, but she can hit these super soprano notes in it. Oh, I just think the lyrics are so beautiful just from the beginning. But yeah, I just love the idea that there's a light over at the Frankenstein place. I just love the idea that there's a draw and beauty and something salvaging in things that are considered weird or dangerous by a lot of people. And that's what that song gets across to me. It's very gently and vulnerably celebratory of the essential weirdness that makes this soundtrack and this movie what it is.
So Consequence of Sound ranked all the songs from the movie. And they said of this one, Over at the Frankenstein Place, though lazy and titling, is stunning in chorus capacity. Besides a Harmony Heaven duet from Bostwick and Sarandon, Hunched Handyman and Rocky Horror creator Richard O'Brien gives one killer Robert Plant of a solo that you must hear to believe. And I guess that's what I get from it. Richard O'Brien's vocals on this are actually like beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah, he's got a great voice. And a strange voice, too. Yeah, I think... Yeah. Also, again, the way that they use the effects on the vocals is very haunting and pretty and... I guess what I'm trying to say is it makes horror look beautiful. and the song does that in the way that it sounds. It sounds the way that it's supposed to feel, which any great song does.
So, I mean, again, this is another random reference, but many of our UK listeners who are of a certain age, about my age, I'd say in their late 20s, early 30s, if they don't remember Richard O'Brien for this, they'll remember him as the host of the game show The Crystal Maze. Have you ever seen The Crystal Maze?
No.
Right, so in the 90s, Richard O'Brien hosted this show called The Crystal Maze, and it's basically you take this team around four different zones and collect crystals, and then at the end they'd go inside a giant crystal and grab as many like gold and silver tickets as they could, and obviously the more they won prizes and stuff, and you got to take home a crystal. And it's like,
wait, are they anything or are they plastic?
The crystals?
Yeah.
I think they're real. I don't know. But this is like, it's come back recently, but he's not doing it, which is devastating. But when it started, Richard O'Brien was the host of The Crystal Maze. So there's so many people who, particularly people who might be listening to this thinking like, well, I've never watched the Rocky Horror Show before. Richard O'Brien, they're thinking of The Crystal Maze. That's what they're thinking of right now.
You know, I really didn't grow up with TV. I just grew up with movies.
Yeah.
So I miss a lot of these references, but that's really funny.
I don't even know if that was shown in America. I'm not sure. But I guess the point I'm making is that what Richard's showing here, obviously, in some corners of UK culture, it's like, oh, it's the guy from the Crystal Maze. He's the guy who wrote Rocky Horror. But he's so much more integral to this production than just the writer, you know, or even the actor, you know, that he really holds his own in a performance where everybody is really on top of their game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, you know, music, book, and lyrics, like, that's a pretty major contribution.
Absolutely.
And then he's a great singer on top of that. And also the fact that he's, you know, he was like a fairly young dude and he was humble enough to like basically dress himself as this very unattractive guy and kind of be on the sidelines while clearly being, you know, the initial and formative talent behind everything, I think is really telling. Because yeah. I think some people would be like, no, I have to be the front man. I have to be Frankenfurter, you know? And that wasn't what he was doing.
So we'll move on to Time Warp, perhaps the best known song from Rocky Horror. Well, I say perhaps it is. And arguably the one that has permeated pop culture the most. What is it about Time Warp that's captured everyone's imagination for over 40 years?
It's just fun. It's just super fun. You can't escape it.
I mean, the song's actually a parody of these kind of dance fads, like the shake or the twist, or like even stuff in the 90s, like the Casper slide and all this kind of stuff that has their own song with an action to go with it.
Yeah.
Yet in the Time Warp, they've ironically come up with like arguably the definitive one. Like if you go to a wedding in the UK, at some point they will play Time Warp.
Really?
It's inevitable. It will happen at some point.
Awesome.
Later in the night when everyone's really drunk, and everybody's like wanting to get up and dance, they will like guarantee you they will play Time Warp. It might be an awful dance remix or it might be the original, but it will get played at some point.
Oh, no. That's really funny. I feel like a lot of people in America have no idea about Rocky Horror. I mean, just like you said, it never permeated middle America. So there are huge pockets of this country where no one would even know that song. So that's really interesting that it's so big in the UK. That makes me really happy. Yeah, it's great. Yeah, it's a great song. It's, you know, I think it's, again, it's got that kind of like Jerry Lee Lewis piano sound on it. And then it's got that like 50s rock feel, but it's a little bit more thrashed out. It's a little bit more rockin'. I love that Meatloaf is on it, even though he's not in the scene. He's just someone else is singing his part. But they're like, yeah, Meatloaf, come on.
I mean, I've been, we'll get into Meatloaf later on when we get to Hot Patootie, but I'm a huge Meatloaf fan. Like, for me, it's Queen and Meatloaf are, like, top of the list for me.
Yeah.
And for years and years and years, until researching for this, I had no idea that Meatloaf sang on Time Warp.
Really?
No idea. And I had to go back, and then I thought, how did I miss that? How on earth did I miss that? You know, from someone who's got all of his albums and been to see him so many times, and I had no idea. But I guess I wasn't looking for him, but... You know, I was happily surprised when I realized that he's on there.
My boyfriend and I tried to watch Dead Ringer for Love the other day, and we were so confused. We're like, wait, what? I really enjoy Meatloaf because I just think he is so weird, and that makes me love people because I'm weird, and when I see that they're weird, I feel that they might understand me. And with that movie, I was like, this dude is super strange. So yeah, I'm falling in love with Meatloaf a little bit myself right now.
So one big difference between the stage production of Rocky Horror and the Rocky Horror Picture Show is the switching of Time Warp with our next track, Sweet Transvestite. So in the original productions, Dr. Frankenfurter makes his entrance and does Sweet Transvestite prior to them singing Time Warp.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on this? And do you think that the film running order works better because we're building up to Frank's entrance at this point?
That's interesting. You know, I've never seen this in a theater. Which is really crazy that I've never gotten to see a stage production, but I really need to. So I guess I would have to see the stage production in order to judge that. But generally speaking, I guess that it probably just works with their stage setup somehow, in a way that they, you know, couldn't change scenery like they can in the movie. So yeah, I don't know. Without seeing the stage production, I can't really judge. But in the film, I think it works. It's a great build up. again, I think it just sort of solidifies something as a hit and makes it accessible. And especially for the time and in general, I think people are just, I don't know, people are judgmental. So the easier that you can establish something as accessible or a hit to them, the more it's going to be accepted by a larger audience. So I think Time Warp probably does that. Because you already know that it's weird. You already know that it's kind of silly. But Time Warp is like the beginning of you're like, huh, okay, it's getting weirder. And so I think if maybe if you open with Sweet Transvestite, people might not even make it to Time Warp, which is really what locks them in.
So Frank's big entrance is next, Sweet Transvestite, and Tim Curry's big moment, or one of many, I should say. Dr. Frankenfurter introduces himself to Brad and Janet, and indeed all of us at this point. So Tim Curry played Frank in the London and Broadway productions of the show. So by this point, he's very comfortable with the character. And you'd said yourself, obviously, that when Meat Loaf had turned up and seen him kind of in the full get-up, that he nearly walked out of the production.
Yeah.
So surely Tim, at this point, is the definitive version of Frank. I mean, there are other people who played him that I'm going to touch on in a minute. But his performance in this film and obviously, I listened to the LA cast recording, which he's also on. Like, his performance is just second to none.
Yeah, I think it's brilliant. I just think it's fucking great. Oh, sorry, can I swear on here?
Yeah, of course you can.
Okay, oh, love it. All right. I've actually been actively holding myself back.
Oh.
Oh, thank you. Okay, yeah, I just think he's fucking great. And I think, I love this song. It's so... Well, let's start with Tim Curry. So yeah, I think his performance is brilliant. I think it's really confident, which would be hard to get with someone who hadn't developed the role so closely to themselves. You know, I think it was really had become like a character of his. And that's what makes it has to be sexy. You know, you don't want Frankenfurter to be repulsive. You want him to be sexy, and that's hard to do, especially at the time, with somebody who's so many things at once. Like, I mean, I know they say transvestite, which is not really a PC word now, but I don't even think that's what Richard O'Brien meant. I've read a little bit about Richard O'Brien's personal life, and he's always saying stuff about like third gender. So I think he's sort of gender queer, if we had to apply like a contemporary term to it. I don't mean to make any assumptions about him that aren't true, so I apologize if that's wrong, but that's just the sense that I picked up from what I was reading. So I think it's more about existing in multiple genders at once rather than being a man masquerading as a woman or transitioning into a woman, because he's very masculine in certain ways and embracing of that. His voice is very masculine. He's, you know, very forceful, and at the same time, really in touch with certain things that people would associate with female sexuality, like, you know, what he's wearing and his long legs and, you know, his sort of dramatic flourishes and what have you.
So at the risk of drifting more into the movie side of things rather than the soundtrack side of things, Lou Adler told Rolling Stone that he believed that Tim should have won an Oscar for his role in this film. I'm guessing that you would agree with that.
1,000% agree with that.
I think, to be fair, if he'd, even 10, 15 years later, if that film had come out, I argue that he would have at least been nominated. But I think it was almost too ahead of its time for the Academy to recognise that kind of thing.
I think maybe now they would. You also remember, like, the Academy, like, they just got Jordan Peele in. You know what I mean? Like, it is just becoming a diverse place. You know, and it hasn't been for most of its time.
So pop culture website Popotique draws strong comparisons to Frank and David Bowie's Ziggy Stardust, saying his persona borrows heavily from David Bowie's creation of Ziggy Stardust. About a bisexual alien rock superstar sent from another planet, Ziggy Stardust represents the definitive rock star, sexually promiscuous, wild and drug intake, but with a message, ultimately, of peace and love. He is destroyed both by his own consumptions and by the fans he inspired. Frank and his creation make a perfect metaphor for what glam was all about. And that's a really good example, I think, of how kind of the attitudes and the ethos of glam are kind of articulated in a character like Frankenfurter.
Yeah, and I think there's this sort of messianic story inherent in glam, I think. This sort of doomed messianic character that I think is central to glam that Bowie actually lived out with Ziggy Stardust, which, I mean, again, this is a tangent, but if you go and listen to the final performance of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars, you can hear Bowie announcing that it's the last performance that they're ever going to do as a band, and he hadn't told the band. So he does that on stage and just blows everything up in public on purpose. So yeah, there is sort of this, like, there's so much excess and fabulousness and wildness and experimentation that it can't quite last, you know? And I think even in something like Velvet Goldmine, which I think of as sort of, probably aside from Rocky Horror, is the quintessential glam movie, that the same thing goes on in that. So yeah, I think it's just an essential message to it.
So Laverne Cox, who would play Frank in the recent TV special, said that the only apprehension I really had about doing the film was the term transvestite. And we've begun to unpick this a little already. That is an antiquated term, but in 1975, when Rocky Horror Picture Show came out, transvestite meant a very different thing. And I guess it is easy to forget in 1975 just how shocking a character like Frank really was, particularly, as we'd said, middle America and what kind of outrage that would cause. I know even as a child growing up in the 1990s, as I was, words like transvestite or transsexual were very alien, taboo concepts to me. And it's taken us quite a lot of time to get caught up to where we are now, where mm-hmm. people are more accepting of all sorts of different walks of life and different genders and all sorts of things.
Yeah, well, the term trans, which is what is used now, it really only evolved in the public eye over the last maybe 4 or 5 years. And before, people used, I don't want to offend anybody, but the words that people used when I was a kid, I don't think were necessarily meant to be derogatory, although I'm sure they were used in a derogatory fashion towards people who were trans, which is why they ended up getting changed. But I just mean around me, it was just the only word. They were the only words that people knew how to describe it. And there was really very little discussion about the difference between someone who just liked to cross-dress. Like, for instance, you know, it's interesting that both are in the song transvestite and transsexual, because transsexual is now what we call transgender. And then transvestite is, you know, cross-dressing. And they're two different things, but he's sort of claiming or playing with both of them. So again, I think at the time he was just playing with whatever words they had for gender play. But I think if anything, if Richard O'Brien was putting anything of himself into the musical, it was his sexuality into Frankenfurter. And I think it's really just about the fluidity of it more than anything else.
So we'll move on to I Can Make You a Man. So by this point in the movie, Frank has taken Brad and Janet to the lab and he's revealed his creation, Rocky. So this is where the sword of Damocles is in the film, and obviously isn't in the version of the soundtrack that we listen to. Frank then sings I Can Make You a Man while he admires Rocky's physique. So with so many outrageous and colourful characters, I've always felt, you were talking about Brad and Janet maybe being somewhat pushing at the sideline. I feel like Rocky is to an extent. And in some ways he's almost the eponymous character, because in some ways the show is named after him. What is the purpose of Rocky for those who are maybe new to the film? And like I say, he is an important character.
Yeah, but I think he's really just Frankenfurter. I think he's really just, you know, Frankenfurter's hubris brought out into something that he can't control. You know, he's the embodiment of this messianic character and his own self-created demise.
So I guess if we go back to that quote I just read before there about comparing Frank to Ziggy Stardust, it ends by saying he is destroyed both by his own consumptions and by the fans he inspired. Frank and his creation make a perfect metaphor for what glam was all about. So even in that quote, just like you have, they've kind of meshed the two together, that Rocky is an extension of Frank and that he is integral to the eventual downfall. You know, we talk about this kind of legend in glam, this idea of that there has to be kind of a downfall at the end, and Rocky's integral to that downfall towards the end of the film.
Yeah, I mean, he's what leads to it. And even, I mean, we'll talk about it later, but that's even in the lyrics to one of the songs. It was all going to plan until he started making a muscle man. You know, that's what changed it for all of them. All of his followers, and they were like, oh, he's gotten too big for his britches. So I think O'Brien meant that to be like the turning point in the plot for his followers.
So we'll move on to one of my favourite songs on the album and from the movie, Hot Patootie, Bless My Soul. Not least, of course, as I told you earlier, how much I love Meatloaf. That would be a big part of why I love the song so much. Meat actually played Eddie and Dr. Scott in the LA run of the Rocky Horror Show. And from what I can gather in a lot of the stage productions, there will be one actor who plays both those parts. And of course, this is all pre-Bat Out of Hell. So Bat Out of Hell came out in 77. So he may have been working on it with Jim Steinman at this point, but obviously the world hadn't heard it yet. What are your thoughts on Meatloaf? I know we touched on him a little bit earlier. And how does Hot Patootie rank for you amongst the more popular songs on the album? Because I would say it's certainly up there in terms of popularity.
I would say after Over at the Frankenstein Place and Sweet Transvestite, this is the one that I listen to the most. It's just a great rock song. It's just really fun to listen to. Again, it's like total Chuck Berry pastiche, but done a little bit harder. And, you know, Meatloaf's vocals are great. He really is a great vocalist. Yeah, I also love the sax solo. I really miss sax solos in rock songs. And this one has a fantastic one.
So, I mean, Richard O'Brien originally wrote the song with himself in mind, but it was director Jim Sharman who encouraged him to play riff-raff rather than Eddie. So it's interesting. I mean, he never saw himself as Frankenfurter, but there was a part of him that perhaps wanted to play Eddie at some point in the production of the musical and the film. The song, therefore, because obviously we've heard the notes that Richard can hit in Over at the Frankenstein Place, the song was too high a key for anyone else who played Eddie until Meatloaf took that role. So they had to change the key for that song and various stage productions of it. But obviously Meatloaf took the role and he was able to hit those notes that that Richard had originally written the song in, which again is testament to what an amazing voice Meatloaf had in the mid-70s. Like, phenomenal.
Yeah.
He did a couple of Motown records with another singer, Stoney and Meatloaf, and it's just great to hear that early Meatloaf voice from there up to about the Dead Ringer album. It's just like a really nice time for Meatloaf, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What a wacky dude, man. You know, again, I feel like because this was such an intimate production and they kind of kept everybody on that was really integral to it and that helped build it up into what it was, I feel like there was some art imitating life or life imitating art, you know, chicken or the egg, I guess, of Meatloaf being really shocked by this character and over time, like being brought in by these British powers and being like, well, it's great music. You know, you can't deny it.
Yeah. So Eddie sings about his love for Saturday night and rock and roll. And it makes this, I think, the most traditional rock and roll song on the album, which would make sense. Bear in mind, of course, that shortly after this, Eddie's bludgeoned to death by Frank with a pickaxe.
Yeah.
So this for me.
And eaten by the crew.
Exactly, yeah. So this for me is perhaps the most blatant moment of the film. I touched on earlier about how this idea of pitting rock and roll of the 50s against the glam of the 70s and this perceived idea that people had, that detractors of glam had, that glam was killing rock and roll. And this is almost it. Literally acted out in front of our eyes that, you know, the rock and roll presence in this film is literally killed with a pickaxe by the glam reference in this film.
Yeah. Which is funny because I feel like glam is very influenced by 50s and 60s rock, you know? So I don't think it would exist without it. And I don't think it necessarily existed outside of it. But I understand, like, in the period, how it could have felt that way.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, being the song is essentially, as we said, this kind of old-fashioned rock and roll number. It is one that's been covered many times over the years. My personal favourite cover, you'll be surprised to hear, is from Brian May from Queen, who covered it as, I think it was like a Japanese bonus track on a solo album in the late 90s. And he does a really cool version of it. And of course, Adam Lambert played Eddie in the recent revival. Why do you think that song is a favourite? Do you think it's just because on its own, it's just a great, good old-fashioned rock and roll number that other bands can cover quite easily and obviously maybe not reach the heights that Meatloaf did, but can do a decent job of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like any great Bob Seger song, you know what I mean? I think it's just like something that you want to groove out to. Again, I think O'Brien's a really masterful lyricist, and it's not that the lyrics in this are particularly complex, it's just that they're all in the right place and they evoke just the amount of nostalgia that is necessary to make the song work.
Yeah, absolutely. So after a reprise of I Can Make You a Man, and you touched on earlier that really you in some ways don't get particularly attached to the reprises, and there's not really much we can say other than that there is kind of a reprise of I Can Make You a Man, showing that Frank's firmly back in control of proceedings.
Mm-hmm.
Our next kind of song outright is Touch You, Touch You, Touch Me.
Mm-hmm.
So I think quite a lot happens between those two songs. So for anyone who maybe hasn't seen the movie, can you kind of catch us up as to kind of what has happened between I Can Make You a Man and Touch You, Touch Me? Because I think that is quite significant as to the themes that we're talking about in this song.
Well, I think, let's see, what leads up to Touch You, Touch You, Touch Me, and I think it started building up before, I guess it's more in between Sweet Transvestite and Touch You, Touch You, Touch Me. Because after Sweet Transvestite, Rocky seduces, in separate rooms, he seduces Janet and then seduces Brad. And Janet awakens this kind of, you know, obviously she's a virgin, and so he awakens this sexual deviancy in Janet, or the sexual need. And then, you know, while all of this drama is going on around, obviously there's like a power play happening between Frankenfurter and the other Transylvanians, the peak of which is him killing Eddie, because Eddie is like the direct threat to his power. So everybody's already on edge. And then in the middle of all of that, Janet's like, well, I finally got some, so I'm gonna take mine. And then in this song, she goes up to Rocky, who, despite all the free love that's going on in the film, you kind of get the sense that Rocky belongs to Frank. And again, it's, you know, it's sort of an extension of him. That's his megalomaniacal love child. So no one's allowed to touch him. And so, yeah, now she's super horny and she sees, you know, a hot giant man baby in a golden underwear, and you know, so yeah, this song is. But again, I think this song is, I think it was pretty controversial to have a woman singing about sex in such a forward and cavalier way, and you know, essentially demanding it. Like, I don't think you saw that in any pop culture at the time.
And I mean, as you've said, this is a song, it's almost about sexual awakening. You know, we've seen Janet as this really naive, innocent woman who's inexperienced sexually, and suddenly after an evening at the Frankenstein place, she's releasing all this pent-up lust and sexuality. And I know that you'd said, we talked about Touch You, Touch Me near the beginning, and you were talking about kind of Susan Sarandon's performance of this and how it's very evident, not only from the movie, but from listening to the song kind of independently, like as part of the soundtrack. How do you think she conveys that in her voice?
Well, she makes straight-up sex sounds in it. She doesn't leave a lot to interpretation. She's really, I don't know, I think it's great. I think she was really brave in this. Yeah, she brings the sexuality into her voice, which is something that was normalized later. You know, you saw it a little bit in like the 80s with, you know, a song like Close to Me by The Cure. And then you saw it like really entering into super mainstream pop culture with somebody like Britney Spears when she was like 16, which is really creepy to me, but whatever. But I think, you know, at the time it wasn't really done for someone to sing and basically sound like they're coming at the same time, but that's what she does.
So, I mean, we've talked about the sexuality of a character like Frank, and as you touched on, in the mid-70s, the idea of a woman openly voicing and exploring her sexual feelings and desires would be, well, I've put here very taboo and outrageous, but I guess it would just be, again, for middle America who are outraged that Kiss of come to play in their local arena, that's tantamount to God knows.
Well, I don't think it's just middle America though, and I think it's apparent in this that, I don't know, and I don't know if it was done on purpose, but I think it is poetic in and of itself that even amidst glam and all of that, there was a ton of sexism. You know, like the men could dress up as women and do all this stuff, but women were treated in a lot of ways as secondary citizens and were oftentimes like very young and kind of at a disadvantage. And, you know, like most of the groupies for all of these glam rock dudes were like 15, you know, or 14 or something. Like, it's pretty dark when you look at it. And I think to have a woman coming up and speaking with such womanly agency is, it can be kind of threatening to power. And it is like the ultimate, even in this, you see to someone who seems as open as Frank and Fritter, it's like the ultimate threat to him, and that's what truly takes him to the edge and makes him crazy and breaks everything apart.
So we'll move on to the next track, which is Eddie, also known in some circles as Eddie's Teddy. So this one's performed by Jonathan Adams, who plays Dr. Scott. So we learn in this one that Dr. Scott is actually Eddie's uncle, and he at this point has come to the castle to try and find his nephew. So this one's a bit more about plot advancement. There's less to talk about kind of the cultural aspects of it than some of the other ones. But in a weird coincidence, I feel like the backing vocals during the chorus of Eddie's Teddy have a really similar vibe to the arrangement of the backing vocals on Bat Out of Hell. But I don't know, maybe it's just kind of the mid-70s vibe or what, but I just thought it was an interesting coincidence that kind of it's a song about Meatloaf's character. And then obviously a couple of years later he'd release an album that I think the backing vocals are very similar, you know, in a complimentary way to what you hear on a track like Eddie.
Well, and as you said, like normally in the stage production, it would have been Meatloaf playing the Doctor. So he would have been singing these lines too. He just would have been playing two different characters. So yeah, I can totally see how that would have crept in there.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of it that way, to be honest. So yeah, that would make sense.
Yeah, I think the song has sort of a Roxy music-ish vibe to it. There's something about the structure of it. It's kind of like a very spaced out cabaret number. But aside from that, it's just like pure comedy. It's just like a really meant to be a comedy number.
And I think, you know, we've talked a couple of times now about how in the theatre productions, Dr. Scott and Eddie are played by the same person. So had they decided to go that route with the film, Meatloaf would have been playing both roles. Do you think that would have worked for the movie? Would you have enjoyed seeing Meatloaf kind of with like another hat on kind of coming in?
Or do you think Meatloaf is perfectly capable of playing multiple characters in the same movie? Although it was very confusing to me in Dead Ringer, at least at the beginning. So I don't know, maybe it would have been confusing in this. I don't know. It would have been funny, but I think it's already so out there that they probably made the right choice just for continuity of having a person play it.
So what we'll move on to next is very different from what we've had so far. Rather than it being three songs outright, it's almost kind of a three-part medley or a suite of sorts leading up to the climax of the film. So the first part is Rose Tint My World, where the characters kind of give us an idea of where they are at this point and how they're feeling. And what I love again is even in this, within Rose Tint My World, there seems to be this face-off between rock and roll and glam, even in this one part. So Columbia, played by Little Nell, although she is like a Transylvanian, she sings first, and there is that kind of traditional rock and roll feeling to it. But then when Rocky comes in, there's this much stronger glam influence. And almost, I mean, I don't know if you listen to much Kiss, it's almost like a Gene Simmons-style delivery of the vocal. Like, can you hear what I'm saying there? That there's, again, even in this one song, this kind of battle between the two is almost intensifying and kind of getting closer within one song.
I also think of it in the structure a lot, because I think there's almost like a, I guess you can feel elements of like Jibriath and, again, not just Roxy Music, but specifically Brian Ferry, who really embodied this kind of cabaret glam. There's elements of that. And yeah, it's super schizo, this song. It goes in and out of totally different musical movements and goes back and forth between them kind of erratically. In a way, it's kind of a prog rock song, honestly, just because it changes structure so many times. And then I like how the ending is almost sounds like the MGM intro. It's like this incredibly regal, over the top, like film studio theme song. So it ends in again, just going back to, this is all about paying tribute to different genres that make this up, I guess.
So we have this fanfare and Frank makes his entrance. And this is kind of the moment where everybody gives in to their urges. And Frank sings, "Don't dream it, be it." So musically, this is one of my favourite moments in the film. And that very phrase, like when I listen to that part, it's a really emotive part of the film. And it's one that I think that fans of Rocky Horror have really taken to heart for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah, "Don't dream it, be it." And then moving into "I'm Going Home," both. Yeah, just that whole succession always makes me really emotional. I don't know. I have a hard time going to the theater productions of it now. When I was a kid, I went to a couple of them and it was fun because, you know, I was like 13 and I had a drag queen writing in lipstick on my head and I was like, this is crazy, cool. But I think now the movie is so precious to me that I actually just really want to hear the music. And with everybody talking over it, it's harder for me. And I really just want to appreciate it as a piece of art now.
It's funny you should say that, because again, that interview with Lou Adler, I haven't got this written down, but when Lou Adler was talking to Rolling Stone, he'd said that You know, he loves the fact that the fans are so passionate, but that he thinks that they ruin it when they kind of shout too loudly, and he wants to be able to hear the film. So he has a very similar kind of viewpoint to you with that.
Hmm. Yeah, I think there are a lot of, I mean, again, they were really smart. They were very self-aware and self-effacing, but there's a lot of really beautiful profundity and eloquence throughout it that you just have to be, you have to listen for it and actually pay attention to see, because it's buried in all of this camp and kitsch. But yeah, it's definitely at the foundation of it. And I think that's what makes it work.
So the third part of that suite is Wild and Untamed Thing, where Riff Raff demands that Frank return to their home planet, Transylvania, as an 8-minute piece between the three parts of the floor show, as it gets called, between Rose Tint My World, Don't Dream It Be It, and Wild and Untamed Thing. Because they're together, do you view them as kind of one thing, or do you view them as three distinct songs? Because I guess when you'd said that it's got so many movements, it's essentially a prog song.
Yeah, I consider
that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, I consider it to be one song. I sort of think of it as like A Day in the Life or Happiness is a Warm Gun, which to me I think of as some of the earliest iterations of prog, and in a way some of my favorite iterations of prog, because it's not so academic. It's just like, we're going to take three things and make them work together because it's fun. And that's what this does to me. And it also shows that there are so many different things that they're pulling from, and so many different warring ideas and concepts. And I think it just, again, it sounds the way that it's supposed to feel. It takes that, all these pretty big concepts, and makes them accessible, because, you know, music is something that just gets right under your skin. It's something that you feel immediately.
And that seems the perfect way to link into I'm Going Home. So in the film, Frank attempts to exonerate himself before saying he'll return to Earth someday with this song. So interestingly, this song was actually written by Richard O'Brien as far back as 1970, but it was reworked for the show because he felt it fitted in well with what was happening. So he didn't even write it with Frank or Rocky Horror in mind. Does the song stand out as a result of that?
This always makes me cry. I think it's so sweet. And like I said, I have a hard time sometimes with sweetness. You know, if it feels too, like it's taking itself too sincerely, sometimes I have a hard time with it. But there's something really heartbreaking about this one, especially in the context of the film, because you just know that he's doomed. And, you know, with all the mascara running down his face, and he just looks crazy. I love the guitar tone, actually. It's a slightly different guitar tone than anything in the rest of the play. And it's super melodic. And again, I think there's kind of a Gibraithy feel to it, although, you know, I doubt that was direct. I just think, you know, I think it was just sort of having his finger on the pulse of what was happening in sound, probably. So, yeah. And I think, again, I think the lyrics are great.
And I think there's something about the lyrics that if we think that he wrote this song independently of Rocky Horror, you know, kind of the themes of like feeling an outcast, and this song potentially, I feel like it gives us more insight into the mind of Richard O'Brien than any other on the soundtrack.
Yeah, it sort of has a similar concept to it as over at the Frankenstein Place, where all the bits of joy and hopefulness that are voiced in it are only possible and are viewed through this sort of outcasted sadness and creepiness, you know? So it's done in a way that makes it, the stakes of that happiness, very real. And as an audience member, you're sort of desperate for it to be reachable for him, even though you know it's not going to be.
So we'll move on to Superheroes, a somewhat somber end to proceedings. So Superheroes leaves Brad and Janet to think about the implication of the night's events. Consequence of Sound actually ranked this one dead last in its ranking of songs from the musical. And it said this about it: one of a handful of songs here you'd swear was written by someone with a hard-on for Ziggy Stardust. Superheroes might be the least impacting track in the Rocky canon. Would you say it's a weak end to the movie? I mean, I know we've got science fiction double feature returns at the end, but do you think it's a weak end to the movie, or do you like the song?
I like the song. I mean, it actually has some of my favorite lyrics. I think some of the best written lyrics, actually. No, I think it's creepy, and I think it's sad, but in sort of a sweet way. I think probably the reason that it annoys people, and I can understand this, is that it ends on such a somber note, and it could also, it could almost be perceived as like a, like there was some sort of moral punishment for all their depravity, which you don't want there to be, you know, because it, you want it to be celebratory. But I don't know if it's really about that. I think it's just more about how these characters are larger than life and they can't quite fit into anything, which if you really look at the film and like what you were talking about, like he should have won an Oscar, you know, all this stuff, like it really was. And the film really did kind of sink into obscurity, and the album was deleted. Like they tried to put it out into the charts and what have you. And it was deleted the year of release. And then it got re-released in 1978 and actually went into the Billboard charts then, but people just really weren't ready for it. And so it did kind of get lost in time and lost in space. And so, yeah, I think that's a very poetic ending. And I think when you have these intimate productions, you know, it's a film that's made for less than $1 million. It's something that comes from a stage play. It's all very personal in so many ways. I think there's a lot of life and art reflecting on one another. So I think it's all the way it's supposed to be.
We end as we began, with a gentle kind of reprise of science fiction double feature that we heard at the beginning of the album. This time the lyrics are recounting what's become of the major players in the movie. So, I mean, I like the cyclical nature of that, that we're starting and ending with the same song, and I feel like it works. How do you feel at the end of this album? Like, I mean, we've been on this massive journey. How does it end the album for you?
Yeah, I like the reprise. I mean, I think it's supposed to be, or as I would say, reprise.
Yeah, I never know which one.
Yeah, I like it. It doesn't actually, for me, it doesn't have as much impact as Superheroes, though. I always sort of think of Superheroes as the end.
Yeah.
And then that's just sort of, you know, rolling as the credits happen.
Because yeah. I guess if you're in a cinema, that's the moment where you, not everyone, but where a lot of people get up and leave when the credits go. So for a lot of people, the end is Superheroes. But then obviously if you're staying till the end, then it's science fiction double feature.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's good to have it wrapped up and then just to sort of remind you that it's a tale and that it's all a tribute to something, and not to not to be too worried about them because it's all just fiction, I suppose.
So nearly 45 years later, the Rocky Horror Picture Show boasts the longest cinematic run in film history. And as we've touched upon, has had an indelible impact on music, fashion, cinema, and popular culture. When asked by Rolling Stone about the movie's appeal, Lou Adler said the following: "It comes down to acting that was so good that it still stands up 40 years later. The music is sort of 50s rock, which is in everyone's musical background, and then there's the participation, which has kept it alive. It's a place for people who are a little outside of the mainstream to meet, and it's a rite of passage. It's a family film." With that in mind, why does the music in the Rocky Horror Picture Show stand the test of time for you?
I mean, it's good. I don't know how else to say. It's just good. I think if they weren't great songs, it wouldn't last. It would just be, you know, a fun, campy B movie that people, you know, showed every once in a while, you know, because, you know, they found a print of it or something. But because the songs are really well written and produced in a way that feels very true to the way that they're supposed to sound, to the creator and everyone that was a part of. Because obviously in a project like this, you have all this collaboration. And then once you have all the people that you want, they bring their own elements to it. So I think it just came together exactly as it was meant to. And that really shows.
And finally, why is the Rocky Horror Picture Show your classic album? And why should people check it out if they haven't already?
Oh, I just think it's a great album. I think it goes through a bunch of different genres. I think it touches on a lot of what glam rock is all about. I think it's a great outsider's album, I suppose. It's just for anyone who feels different. It's really heartening and it makes you feel like you're a part of something.
Well, Savannah, thank you very much for joining me. I've had an absolute blast talking about Rocky Horror tonight. It's been awesome. I was just curious what you're up to at the moment. I recently saw the video for your new single Rock and Roll No More. So what's kind of going on for you if people are wanting to kind of check out what you're up to?
Yeah. Okay. So my album, which is my debut solo album since before, as you may or may not know, I was in a pure glam rock band called Space Cream, but now I am out on my own, and I'm putting out my first album called Atlantis, and that's coming out on April 26th on, you know, every major platform that, you know, you would think of.
A very special thanks to Savannah Pope for taking time out to chat with us on My Classic Album and for being the first person to choose a soundtrack. The Rocky Horror Picture Show, what a movie, what a soundtrack. And I hope that we do a couple of soundtracks every now and again. You know, obviously the studio albums, that's the bread and butter. That's why we do this podcast. But no harm at all in throwing a soundtrack in there every now and again. And Rocky Horror seems to me that it was the perfect one to start with. As I touched on earlier, Savannah's debut album Atlantis is out now. You heard Rock and Roll No More earlier on. You can hear the whole album on wherever you're streaming music. You know, it's out everywhere. I posted a video on the My Classic Album Facebook page, well, shared a video, should I say, of Savannah performing at the Troubadour. And, you know, it's the full gig. Awesome stuff. You know, she's an amazing live performer. And if you want to know more about Savannah, perhaps you want to check her out live, perhaps you want to get the album, get yourself over to www.savannahpopmusic.com. And that's all the time we've got for another episode of My Classic Album. Thank you very much for joining me, as always. Our next episode, I'll be welcoming Damon Johnson onto the show. Now, a lot of you will know Damon from his time in bands like Brother Kane, Black Star Riders, and Thin Lizzy. Damon has chosen The Police's Synchronicity as his classic album, and as always, we'll break the album down and we'll be going through it track by track. That's on our next episode of My Classic Album in just a couple of weeks. I'll see you all then. Cheers!